Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
I can't tell you how happy I am to be speaking with you about Fear Below.
Oh, thank you very much.
I love crime thrillers. I love shark movies. Your marriage here with it being a crime thriller that happens to have a shark in it is fantastic. But you've done some things that, with the thousands and thousands of movies that I have seen. And I think almost every shark movie ever made. I've seen some really cheesy C and D grade shark movies that might have happened on a river in the United States where a shark got stuck somewhere and came up the Mississippi River. But I have never seen an inland river situation like this set in Australia. We've seen plenty of shark films on the coast of Australia, but never inside. But above all, nothing set in 1946 anywhere in that time period. No one has done this before. I am thrilled that you have, and I am thrilled with the result.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad that we attempted to do something a little bit unique and different, and it sounds like we succeeded.
You sure did. So I have to ask you, when you decided you're going to do a period piece, you're going to have crime, yeah, you want to have a shark in it, how did picking that 1945-1946 era, how did that impact you in the story structure itself?
Well, for me, it was about when I was suggested by somebody that I write a shark film, because as my one of my producers said, write a shark film, Matt. I can always sell a shark film. So I went away and tasked myself with trying to write the kind of shark film that I wanted to see. And I've always had a great interest in deep sea diving, especially the deep sea diving of the old, of old times where they wore the big diving helmets.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was an opportunity to, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be terrifying and scary and a very unique thing to see people in old diving outfits having to deal with a shark where they can't swim away quickly and, they're sort of stuck down there. And so it was really about trying to find a reason for the divers to go in the water and to be stuck with the diver, stuck with the shark. You know, if there's a shark in the water, the easiest way to avoid it is to just stay out of the water, right?
Yep.
But I had to come up with a story that made our characters have to go back in the water again and again and again. So I devised a plot that would create that circumstance.
And it works brilliantly. But what doing this also gives you is a great visual opportunity in terms of your production design, your costuming, and finding diving helmets, such as the Captain Nemo-style diving helmets that were being used forever into the 1940s, and, the whole how you're pumping air down, because there was no such thing as air tanks there.
Exactly.
So you make the most. You really celebrate that, and I found it very educational at the same time, I have to tell you, Matthew.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad. A lot of people have said that they've learned quite a lot from the film in learning how that old dive equipment worked, and also many people were not aware that bull sharks go into freshwater rivers, and here in Australia, bull sharks are a very real threat. And especially in the north, the bull sharks absolutely are going up and down those rivers and will sometimes go in hundreds of miles inland and live there in the rivers for years. So it's a very real thing, and a lot of people just aren't aware that bull sharks do that. So,
mm-hmm.
And bull sharks are a shark that attack people more than any other shark, more so than the great white, because they tend to favour the kinds of water that people swim in, like fresh water and shallow, murky water.
They know where to find dinner.
They certainly do. So I was hoping, I was hoping that this film would sort of give audiences something very unique and something, and be a little bit educational as well.
Well, Well, and you follow through with all of that in spades, and particularly when it comes to the shark itself, because we don't see that much of it. You're very judicious in how often and how much shark we see. And because of the river itself, which I understand you shot with a dry for wet scenario and not actually under the water, that adds so much more. But then your shark, VFX or animatronic or puppetry, the teeth, you really feature the teeth because they are much smaller than a great white's teeth. But your shark has them so perfectly sharpened, and they're clean, and they're not eaten away by deep sea elements. So you really can appreciate when that shark takes a bite, he's taking a bite.
Yeah. Yeah, he's, like you said, we've seen so many shark films over the years, and everything is going to be compared to Jaws, and for me, it was about how many things could I do different to make the film unique. And I thought the river, the species, the time period, and the plot and the reason for them to keep going in the water gave the characters a lot more agency rather than just stranding them on a raft or stranding them on a surfboard or a rock or something like that. It gave the characters a lot more to do than just sit there and wait to get attacked. So it really was about, just trying to devise, the most unique blend of genre for, to make it more than just a shark film. And and ultimately, in the end, for me, it's all just about the characters. If you love the characters, you're invested in the journey of these characters, you'll go along with them for the ride. So for me, we worked the most hard on getting the characters right.
The characters are fantastic. And the casting. I was so excited when I saw that Jacob was in this film. I first saw him in Steven Johnson's High Ground a few years ago. I just fell in love with him and that film.
Yes.
So to see that he was in here, I couldn't wait to see the film just to see what he was going to be doing in this film.
Terrific.
You just fall in love with him. He's charming, he's kind, he's truthful. He wants to do a good job. He wants to protect Clara. He worries about Ernie. And he's the first one who's willing to step up to the plate to do something. And he's proud of his Aboriginal heritage.
Yes, indeed.
An amazing character. You just really knocked it out of the park in crafting the character of Jimmy and then casting Jacob in that role. And similarly, Arthur Angel as Ernie is fantastic. For Hermione Corfield, this should be a breeze for her in this film as Clara, considering one of her early screen performances was as an X-Wing fighter in one of the Star Wars movies. So facing off with a shark, got to be a piece of cake. How difficult, and then of course we have our criminals and Jake Ryan. I don't know why more people have not heard of Jake Ryan. He is fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Blend of menace and charm, that character.
Yeah. I love to see how he does not take his suit jacket off for the bulk of the couple days. He's got the tie. He loosens the tie. The hat. He generally has the hat tilted a little bit, trying to give with the brow down just enough to give him, kind of a nice Al Capone look, shall we say.
Yes.
Just amazing. And you've got the very boyish Maximilian Johnson who plays Sean. Of course, Josh McConville, he looks like he just came out of Nazi Germany after they lost in 1944.
We made him, we were playing around with the character's ethnicity. Should he be Italian? Should he be Russian? But we finally settled on Polish.
Mm-hmm.
Because we knew someone that could, provide him a lot of good Polish, words and things like that. And it just felt, again, we were trying to go buck the trend. I guess the trend would be make him German, make him Russian, make him Italian or something like that. But we thought, let's find something a little bit out of the box. And so we decided a Polish would be a good, would be, you know, someone who was probably tangled up in doing something illegal in World War II and got over to Australia after the war and has been, you know, living a nefarious lifestyle ever since. So, yeah, it was fun. It was a lot of fun, and a lot of the actors brought a lot of their own ideas to every role to make each of them stand out and feel quite unique, which was terrific.
How difficult was it to cast these parts? Because these aren't run-of-the-mill parts because of the very nature of the film.
Well, it wasn't too difficult, actually. I mean, it was a bit of a hunt for Hermione because we did offer the role to so many Australian actresses, but we got turned down by all of them. So we finally decided that, okay, well, if the Aussie girls don't want to do it, we'll take it to the English, seeing that Australia and England have very close ties, especially in that period. So, and as soon as I saw a picture of Hermione, she just jumped out at me as, well, that's her, that's Clara, that's my mind's eye vision of that character, and she just turned out to be perfect for the part. I actually wrote the role of Ernie for actor Arthur Angel.
Oh.
I had worked with him before. And I knew that he would suit this. So when I wrote it, he was always the only person in my mind for Ernie, as was it for Jacob. After seeing him in High Ground, there was no one else in the role for him but that actor.
Yeah.
And the other guys, very, very easily, we found them very quickly. You know, when someone recommended Jake Ryan, he was the obvious choice, having, knowing his, you know, his, how great he comes across as the big heavy bad guy. Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't that hard to cast. And of course, I've just recently worked with Clayton Watson, who plays poor old Bob, the fisherman.
Oh, yes, poor Bob.
And after finishing, he was in my last film, The Cost. And we just decided, as soon as we love working with him so much, we just thought, well, where could we put him in this film? And so we gave him Bob. So it was a very easy casting process and didn't take us long at all.
Now, once you had your cast in place, you've got this great script in place, and you really have to make the visuals pop and come to life, what kind of challenges did your costume designer, Tracy Rose Spark, did an amazing job with the period costuming, especially coming up with the dive uniforms for Clara, Jimmy, and Ernie, but also Esther Rosenberg, because under production design, you're also going to have to come up, you're going to have to find the car, the period-appropriate car, you're going to have to find that dive equipment, and then, of course, all that wonderful set dress inside Ernie's dive business. What kind of challenges?
Yeah, it was a bit of a challenge, yeah. Well, we were very fortunate in that we had, right, even before we had even cast the movie, I had a professional diving consultant read the script and advised me on how the gear works, and he provided most of the real diving helmets that you see and suits that you see in the movie. That's all his actual gear that actually works and is used for hard hat, standard dress diving, and he provided all of that. So we already had a leg up in all of that equipment, and then it was up to Esther and Tracy just to source as much as they could with the budget that we had to fill in the rest. So, yeah, having our diving consultant, really, really helped us with equipment and so on. Because it was a very challenging production. We had flooding, actually, in the because we were shooting on the river. But in our first week of shooting, we had massive rains and lots of floodwaters coming down from the north, and the river broke its banks. Every single one of our locations was flooded, and we had to be evacuated out of the town that we were based in, and production was delayed about 6 weeks until we could find a whole new river location. So we were being hit by Mother Nature when making this film, and we had to make a lot of compromises and readjust very, very quickly in order to get the film shot. So we were certainly facing, it was not an easy film, but it was easily the most difficult film I've ever had to make. Even though we weren't shooting underwater because of the dry for wet, the above water stuff on the river was extraordinarily difficult due to the, due to Mother Nature here in Australia.
Talk to me about working with your cinematographer. You've worked with Peter before, and some of the beautiful, because everything, the bulk of the film is contained in the one area on the riverbank. and in boats on the top of the water, with maybe poor Clayton having to get in the water at one, so we can see him in the water.
Oh, yeah, they were in that water, all right.
The cinematography is beautiful. It's very natural looking, it's very organic looking, which then you carry through into the dry for wet of underwater.
Yes, yes.
So I'm curious.
Yes, well, my cinematographer, Peter Sylvester, I've worked with him on The Legend of Ben Hall. I'm working with him right now on my next film, The Sundowner. And he and I go way back to high school together. We made movies together as teenagers. And then in our adult life, we, you know, when he went off and became a great cinematographer, I went off and became a director, and then we joined forces, and we've been making movies for the last over 10 years now together. So we have that great shorthand with each other. And Peter's great at capturing the Australian landscape in a very natural way, and lighting, you know, off the hip, and you know, doing things very. Making things look beautiful when, you know, you're up against time, you can still make shots look beautiful. We spoke a lot about the underwater look of the movie and how it can be both murky and yet you can still see something, so the audiences aren't looking at pitch black. And so we studied a lot about what rivers look like underwater, the colour, you know, how much you can see, and he worked very, very hard on lighting that dry for wet set to make it look very natural. So it's a real testament to his pre-planning that we could achieve that look. And we would slow the we shot the actors who were taught to walk in a certain way. We shot it at a faster frame rate, so when slowed down, they took on a more weightless sort of look to make it look like they were pushing through water. So it was certainly a huge lighting challenge for Peter, both above water and, you know, quote unquote underwater, because we were pushed for time, and we were pushed for, we were doing it on a very limited budget, and so the fact that it looks as good as it does is a great testament to his work.
It looks above water looks fantastic, and I do love the fact that it's a very natural element. And when you think of Australia, when you think of the outback, or you think of a lot of the places that Steve Irwin exposed people to with his crocodile hunting, you get that back to nature feel with this film.
Yes, very much so. I think shooting on a real location really helps that. I mean, we were that river that we were on was a little estuary, like a little offshoot of a main river, 4 hours inland from Brisbane, in Queensland, and it very much was out in the wild, and it was out there in the middle of nowhere. So we were absolutely in the mud with the flies and the mosquitoes and the bullfrogs and the snakes. It was a very we were very much in and amongst nature. It was a very tough shoot.
Yeah, because I saw some of those flies landing on the actors.
Oh, the flies up there are incredibly difficult. In fact, most of the crew had to wear fly nets over their faces while we were filming. The poor actors couldn't. They were non-stop because it is cattle country up there. And, of course, that means a lot of flies. So, yeah, especially along the river where the cattle come to drink. So, yeah, it was... We were up against every creature, great and small, up there.
Oh, my gosh.
Fortunately, no bull sharks up there. We did actually look at some rivers in Australia when we had to find a new river. We actually did look at some rivers, and we actually rejected it because we were like, nope, we can't put our actors in that river because there are bull sharks in it. So we had to find a river and that was, you know, far inland enough that we knew that there were no bull sharks in it, and that we knew there were no crocodiles in it.
Oh, that's right. You've got to look out for both kinds of predators.
That's right. And so we had to be very selective to make sure we weren't in crocodile territory and that we weren't in bull shark territory.
Well, I'm sure your insurance company appreciated that fact, that you took that seriously.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I do have to compliment you again on the dry for wet, that underground, because you've got the murkiness, the muddiness, the yellowy-green tint where the sun is, like, kind of trying to come down, but can't really. But it's interesting that you did slow down the frame, because I would swear, watching it, I would swear that they were lumbering through trying to move on the bottom of the river. Just so authentic looking.
It was one of those things that people, when I first conceived the movie, I immediately thought, we're going to do the diving this way. We're going to do it dry for wet. This is how I achieve it. It was no question in my mind that it would work. But it was a huge thing. I couldn't, when I would tell producers and people about it, they couldn't get that through. They couldn't quite understand that this would work. But I assured them, and Peter was right beside me, no, we can absolutely achieve this. And we actually had to shoot a test. We hired a studio. We put on some dive. I put on the diving gear. Peter lit it, and we did it, and it worked. But we had to shoot that test first to convince everybody that the whole movie could be achieved this way. We would never been able to shoot this movie had we not used that technique. It would have taken us so many weeks, maybe even months.
Yeah.
With, you know, in a water tank, teaching actors, you know, the safety and the time of shooting underwater would have just simply, would have been feasible. It would have been unsafe. So it's great that we can use these really old school techniques to achieve in one day, you know, what would normally take us weeks. So, you know, directing them walking on the bottom of a river, as soon as we called cut, I would just walk straight up to the actor and look them through the face hole and say, oh, that was great, let's do another take, and walk back off set again, and off they go. So it was probably shooting underwater was actually much easier than shooting above the water. If
that makes sense. It makes perfect sense. So I have to ask you about how you created the shark. Because I also notice on the credits, we've got puppeteering, we have shark doubles. So I'm curious what you did to create this shark. Did you go puppetry or animatronic with this? Did we have people inside ahead of a bull shark? Talk to me about what you did to create this magic, because it's fantastic.
Thank you very much. Yes, Steve Boyle of Formation Effects, he was responsible for the shark. Him and his team did a great job, though, again, it was very challenging because of the limitations of time and budget. But what they pulled off was fantastic. We pulled every trick in the book, and we started with the old tricks first. So the shark was done in a myriad of ways. But the two things we didn't want to do was we didn't want to use real shark footage, because going out and trying to film a bull shark in a river is an extraordinarily difficult thing. And I didn't want to use digital shark, because I felt that's kind of been overused and would kind of break the old world 1940s sort of look. So we did a combination of puppetry and miniatures, a lot of miniatures. And all sorts of, you know, rope and pulley, you know, tricks that, you know, that have kind of been lost and forgotten in a lot of movies now. Mm-hmm. So it really was an old school approach that we took. We had a large full-scale shark that was puppeteered to attack the divers in the dry for wet set. We had pieces of the full-scale shark, like a fin, a tail, and a head, that a diver would operate there on the river. By just going underwater and launching the head up through the water, and he would puppeteer that. And we also had a small miniature shark that was puppeteered to swim through frame and things like that. So you're really watching a combination of all kinds of effects that build together into this one seamless effect of this shark. I think there's a few shots there that have some digital enhancement. Mm-hmm. But very few, perhaps maybe half a dozen, that have some digital augmentation just to get us out of a corner. So it really is old school. The whole movie, both in its setting and its story and the approach to the filmmaking, was let's go back to the old ways.
Oh my God. And that just tickles me, because as you said, people forget about the old ways. They forget about the analog world.
That's right.
And how things were done.
This is how Jaws was made, and we figured, well, Jaws did a pretty damn good, so we'll go back to that.
Yeah.
To make it unique, we'll do something that people really aren't doing these days. We'll go back to the old school ways. I mean, most of the actors, when they're swimming underwater at the end, when without their diving gear, and that was all shot in a 5 meter swimming pool in the back lot. You know, not in a river. You'd never know they were swimming in just a tiny little swimming pool, not much bigger than something you'd see in someone's backyard. But we just lit, Peter just lit it right, and we made the water murky with pigmentation and soy milk, and no one's going to know.
Wow. Wow. Peter is masterful with his lighting. To pull off what he pulled off and created, he is a master with lighting.
I think so too.
Now,
I
got to ask you, did Esther or did anybody happen to stumble on some actual bars of gold bullion for you to use and maybe, you know, slip one in your pocket to help finance the film?
I wish. I would have loved to have had a big 25 boxes of gold bullion to finance the film. That would have gone a long way. We didn't actually get... I think she did, if my memory serves me correctly, but don't quote me on it, she did get access to some gold bullion, at least to get a sense of its texture and understand how it shines, how it works, and that way she could replicate that. But, I mean, it's just a testament to Esther's great production design that she was able to make all those gold bullion bars read like real gold. She did a fantastic job of that in a very short amount of time as well. So, yeah, there was a lot of very ingenious people that were, you know, coming up with all kinds of tricks, you know, under a very, very short time and money pressure.
Mm-hmm. And I've got to ask you about your composer, about Angela Little and your score, because the score is such a wonderful undercurrent for the period, for the crime thriller aspect. It doesn't succumb to the Jaws, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We don't get any of that. The score really stays focused in the tension of the crime, and you've got criminals on the beach holding guns on Clara, Jimmy, and Ernie. That's what...
Yes,
that's
Angela was, again, approached it, I suppose, a bit more like a traditional, old-fashioned film score that, you know, that had the, you know, the sort of the, you know, the sweeping music cues and... you know, and the soundscapes that sort of complemented the Australian bush, and of course, a lovely, that sort of lovely colonial kind of haunting soundscape to it as well, which again was just trying to harken back to, you know, an older time. When Greg Moss and myself wrote this film, it was very much, we wanted to harken back to adventure movies of the 80s that we grew up with, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jaws, things like that. So in every aspect of the production, we were constantly going, well, if we made this film in that time period, what would we do? And the music was very much a part of that as well. What kind of music score would we have done in the 80s or some in the early 90s, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Now, how difficult was your editing process on this one? How lengthy was it?
It was quite lengthy because of our there were aspects and shots and scenes that were not able to be filmed either as well as we wanted to because of the time restraints and the budget cuts that the flooding caused. So we had to get very, very creative with the editing process. I was very heavily involved in the editing, and then it was passed over to Matt Villa and Stu Schwerk to finish it off and tighten up. So it was very complicated and long editing process, you know, and trying to get the shark to, you know, to work, as all shark films have that problem, getting the shark to work. So, and there were some reshoots that were done by Steve and his team. Little inserts to punch up the shark moments that we just didn't have time for in principal photography. So it was a very long process, and but ultimately one that seems to have panned out quite well.
I certainly think it has. And of course, the fact that you have, in 1946, a woman and an Aboriginal on equal footing with a business owner, a white male business owner, speaks, is so far ahead of its time. And I think just fantastic representation and commentary within the story itself, Matthew.
Oh, thank you. Yes, we very much wanted to have Ernie be quite a progressive character for that time period, in that he's the kind of guy that gives those who, you know, women and Indigenous people in Australia were looked down upon, as you see in the movie, by the attitudes of the gangsters towards them, that, you know, they were the more the second-class citizens. They were not looked upon as, you know, capable of doing the job that the men could do, which we wanted to sort of make a comment on. But, you know, Ernie, being a more free-thinking, more open-minded character, has brought them on board because he sees their potential. And, of course, as the story goes on, we see the potential of those two characters, of Clara and Jimmy, and they more than prove themselves worthy of the task. So, it was definitely something we wanted to explore and touch on, you know, the racial and sexual discriminations of that time period, because they were very real and present in the 1940s, and it was something that we wanted to make a comment on.
You do it beautifully. You express it beautifully in the film. And I have one last question for you here, Matthew. How beneficial was your early work doing stop motion? How beneficial was that for you to make a film like Fear Below, especially with creating the shark?
I think it was instrumental. Being from a world of stop motion, puppetry, shooting, you know, working on hundreds of commercials and dozens of short films that were all about in-camera effects, I got 10 or 15 years of education on what can be achieved in camera, how you achieve things on camera, what you can get away with. And that schooling in those old world techniques, not the digital world. I've never been a digital, you know, I've never learned computer animation. I never did computer animation. So what it did is everything I studied and everything I practiced was practical. And so my head was in the practical mode. And I don't think if I'd had that animation and puppetry background, I would never have been bold enough to, you know, go with dry for wet techniques. I never would have gone for a practical shark. I never would have done any of those things. So I think it really got my head into a place where I could make a film like Fear Below. So I think it was instrumental and vital for me to have come from that background in order to make a film like this.
I love Fear Below. As I said at the top, it is the most original, unique shark film that's not a shark film, that's a crime thriller that happens to have a shark in it, that I have ever seen in 43 years as a critic and a lifetime of movies. I love this film and what you did, Matthew. I so want to see more. I want to see more of this expertise and in camera and old school talent.
Well, I've certainly got many scripts lined up that would be that are full of old school techniques that I want to try. We do have sequel ideas. We've got lots of things in our back pocket. So if anyone wants me to make another one and they've got the money for it, I'm ready when they are.
Oh, Matthew, thank you so much. This has been an absolute joy to get to speak with you about Fear Below. And hopefully we'll chat again in the future, Matthew.
I hope so. Thank you, and thank you for all your kind words.